You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show without Brian Callen. That's right. Brian Callen is such a huge star. I mean, he's just on so many TV shows that apparently there is literally not a minute of the day that he is available in November, which is unfortunate because our next guest is his book is fantastic. We first heard about it through Lawrence Lessig, who's a big fan of the show, we hope, because we're certainly big fans of his. Professor Zingales, you're a professor at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business. That's correct, right?
Yeah.
Yes. And you've written a number of books. And actually, the one that Lessig recommended was one of your older books. But today we're going to talk about your newest book, A Capitalism for the People. So this book really, and really all of your work, comes out of your own experiences growing up in Italy, correct?
Yes, I think that I came to this country because I was attracted by the functioning of the market system, the meritocracy of this country. And personally, I receive everything I dream of. But over the time I spent here, that now is 27 years, I noticed that some of the negative characteristics of Italy were starting to emerge here. And so I decided to write my latest book, A Capitalist for the People, to actually highlight these problems, because I think I have a unique vantage point.
Right. And I mean, some of those unique aspects are things like nepotism, which originally is an Italian word, right?
It is an Italian word. Yes, indeed.
You have the distinction of being from the place that invented cronyism, or at least, you know, epitomized it.
Absolutely.
So specifically, when we talk about those sorts of things that were happening in Italy, you talked about how basically in order to get a job as a professor, it wasn't based on merit, it wasn't based on the quality of your work, but based on, you know, your connections and you're willing to essentially kiss up to the right people.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so when we talk about, I mean, there's a reason, obviously, why Lessig particularly recommended your book, because obviously that's a lot of what he sees going on with campaign finance in Washington, that it's no longer about, you know, a meritocratic, inclusive process and is much more about influence peddling.
Absolutely. And I think that campaign financing is an important aspect. Unfortunately, it's not the only aspect.
No, not at all. And I thought that, I mean, one of the most powerful ideas in your book, and there are a lot of them, is the idea, the distinction between pro-market and pro-business. Would you mind explaining that for us?
Yes. Most people think that the two terms are synonym, but being pro-market means being in favor of competition. And businessmen are in favor of competition when they want to enter a new industry. The moment they are in an industry, they want to create barriers to entry to charge higher prices. And to the extent these barriers to entry are created in what I call a fair way, in a sense through better product, technological lead, and so on and so forth, that's what capitalism is about. When these barriers to entry are created through the help of the government, that's basically distorting competition. And this is where there is a big sort of tension between being pro-market, being pro-business.
And obviously, I mean, you know, again, you use in your book the example of Berlusconi. And Berlusconi is obviously a man who we can all recognize as not pro-market. He does not believe in fair competition. He does not believe that the best products should win. He believes in structuring the government and structuring the country in such a way that it serves his interests. He's pro-business, his own business.
Yeah, I think that sort of seeing the experience of Berlusconi made me more allergic. But I have to say, a lot of people in Italy still think, and definitely thought at the time when he started running, that he was representing the market because he was a businessman and because he was using some of the language that pro-market people use. He fooled a lot of people. And I think that, if I may say, that's exactly what is happening with Donald Trump. I think that he's a businessman, but in a businessman, in a sector that is not competitive, is real estate, a sector where cronyism is the name of the game. And I think that some voters certainly think that he is pro-market, but I think he's the ultimate example of a pro-business.
So you would say that there's, in some sense, Trump may be America's Berlusconi?
Oh, I've said this 4 years ago, but seriously, I wrote an article about this. But now what I'm concerned about is the fact that he gets some traction in the United States. I think that's a sign that what I'm saying is correct, that the United States is becoming more like Italy. For many years, Americans will ask how people vote for Berlusconi in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And now I sort of ask back why there are so many supporters for Trump in the United States.
And it really is because they just don't understand that distinction, I think, between pro-market and pro-business. They see...
I think that that's a big component. But the other part, which I think most people don't fully appreciate, is Berlusconi in Italy was seen as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
And you say, how can the richest man in Italy be seen as an outsider? he was for a number of reasons. One is that he did not belong to the usual sort of elite, and so was seen as somebody entering that elite from the outside.
Mm.
He was not born poor, but he wasn't born super wealthy, and so people identify with him. The second is that he was so powerful from a media point of view that he could pick a fight with anybody and win.
Mm.
And Trump has some of the same characteristics. Trump can pick a fight with Fox and not be afraid for the rest of his campaign.
Mm.
And no Republican candidate can do that today. And I think that that is paradoxically an attraction of Trump. But people are attracted to the wrong person for the right reasons.
Right, exactly. And I mean, I think that in terms of the ways in which, I mean, you know, in the book, you talk about Horatio Alger. And for our listeners who may not be familiar, Horatio Alger, there were these stories. I mean, I think it's from the end of the 19th century.
Yeah.
And they're basically these stories of people who, you know, start off poor, but because of their virtue and their hard work and their tenacity, basically end up living out the American dream and, you know, end up succeeding. And, you know, in the book, you're basically saying that that's really what this pro-business stance that has developed, this anti-market stance, ends up killing. It ends up really basically destroying the American dream, and you start pushing towards a country that's more like Italy or Mexico or all of those other places that have the illusion of capitalism or the illusion of democracy, but in practice are really just, you know, oligarchies.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so, I mean, how do you think that obviously, hopefully this interview helps. Your book is certainly a huge contributor to that in terms of understanding that distinction. But, you know, how do you think that America, so if you were, I mean, Brian likes to ask the question, if you were emperor, which is, you know, obviously the opposite of what you would need to be in order to actually return this country to a true democracy or a true capitalist society, you know, what would you do? What are the sort of reforms that we need to enact?
I think that, first of all, I will never appoint myself emperor. that's rule number one. But and you said very correctly, I think that whoever is the emperor is going to destroy the system. I think that one of the secrets of the U.S. Framework is to have a lot of check and balances.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think that that's the solution. I'm actually an idealist at heart. I do believe that books and academia and research and promotion can make a difference. I think that at the moment there is not a understanding in the United States, number one, of the difference between being pro-market, being pro-business, and two, how much business is distorting the rules of the games
mm-hmm.
in favor of the incumbent business. And I, in the book, I use this metaphor that I'm enamored, if I may say, of about in the Grand Canyon, the Grand Canyon Park. There is a note by saying, "Please don't feed the wild animals." And underneath, they explain that you shouldn't feed them because if you feed them, they lose the ability to get food in the wilderness. And even if you think you're doing something pro-animal, you're actually damaging them long term.
Mm-hmm.
And this is my view of business. I love business, and precisely because I love business, I don't want business to be subsidized. I don't want business to be too powerful and change the rules of the games, because this is long-term detrimental to the benefits of business itself. I think that what people don't fully understand is that monopoly is or market power is not only damaging consumers, of course, but long term it damages the very organization that have that monopoly. You mentioned that nepotism was invented in Italy. Actually, nepotism was invented in the Catholic Church. Why? Because the popes were favoring their own children. Now you say, wait a minute, can't they have children? Yeah, they cannot have children, but sometimes they did have children. And they sort of call them nephews. The word nipote is nephew in Italy, which is a polite way to say their children. And why the Catholic Church could afford to do that is because it was a state-sanctioned monopoly. At the time, if you were trying to compete with the ideas of the Catholic Church, you were burned alive, and a pretty strong way to enforce monopoly. And in a monopolistic organization, you can appoint your cronies and friends, and the organization in the short term could survive. Now, compare this with Protestant Church in the United States. It's not that the message of religion is so different. It's the fact that here, even in religion, there is competition. Mm. If you appoint an idiot ahead of a parish, that parish would disappear because the churchgoers would go to a different parish. And as a result, there is today much more religiosity in the United States than in Catholic Italy. So monopoly is bad for the very organization that receives it.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think we've obviously seen that in recent history. I mean, with all of the scandals that have happened in the Catholic Church in the United States, and you find a lot of Catholics are suddenly not showing up to church or suddenly, you know, being attracted to other denominations.
Absolutely. And I have to say, I actually love this new pope. And I think that part mm-hmm. of the reason why this new pope was elected is because of the scandals in the United States and because of the pressure to change. So even in that sense, sort of competition leads to a change in the oldest organization in the world, which is the Catholic Church.
Right. But if they'd achieved their sort of 16th century vision and established one true universal church across the entire globe, you can only imagine where the Catholic Church would be today.
Yes, it would be even worse than where it is today.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's the interesting irony is that obviously, you know, so much of, I think, what is going on in U.S. politics in terms of, you know, economics is really, I mean, it's all drawn from the lessons of the Cold War. Everybody looks at the Cold War, they're like, the Soviet Union failed, clearly communism has failed, and so therefore, you know, it's all about capitalism. But the interesting thing is the way in which elites have captured that and perverted it and made it into, so therefore, you know, we have to subsidize business and essentially do all the things that the Soviets were doing.
Absolutely. No, I grew up in Italy, 50 miles away from communist Yugoslavia, in a country that had the largest communist country in the West. And in my youth, I was afraid that the commie will take over my country. So there is nobody as anti-communist as me. The reality is that the idea of communism has been defeated. And as a result, there is nobody that pressures sort of capitalists to keep in check.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, they started to become more and more aggressive. And at the end, they are undermining the very system who created them.
Right, right. And I mean, should we be calling, you know, should we start? I mean, it's appropriate that the Republican Party maybe is the Red Party then, because essentially they are in some sense supporting state-run enterprises.
Absolutely. But I have to say, unfortunately, none of the two parties has a monopoly on this.
No,
I think both parties are in bed with business.
Mm-hmm.
And both parties, at least the establishment of both parties, don't really understand how problematic this is. And then you have some sort of lonely people like Larry Lessig on one side and some people on the Republican side on the other that sort of try to fight the right battle. But they are minorities that don't receive any attention, unfortunately. This is Larry started a very courageous campaign but got no traction because nobody wanted to discuss these issues.
Well, I think it's not that nobody wanted to discuss the issue. I mean, just from our own experience having him on the show and talking about it, people are very positive. But, you know, the Democratic Party did everything they could to, interfere with his candidacy. They made no attempt to give him any sort of inclusion in the debates, even though that he clearly could have, you know, met the standards. So, I mean, I think, you know, the two-party system, I mean, there really is... they like the system. Obviously, they like the system as it is. It serves, it maintains two parties. They know how to play that game. They really don't want to learn a new game, as incumbents never do. And so, you know, reform is fundamentally not interesting to them.
Absolutely. But I think that we need people like Larry trying, and eventually somebody will succeed.
Yeah, 100%. And I think also that it really is, I mean, again, that pro-market versus pro-business idea, I think, is so important to understand, because that is, I mean, you know, Brian and his dad, like, often have these conversations essentially about, you know, the sort of libertarian ideal. But I don't think that a lot of the people who are trying to be... who are trying to essentially support business realize that they are supporting incumbent businesses rather than supporting competition.
This is an interesting question. To what extent people don't understand, and I think that the people at large probably don't understand, but to what extent the intellectual who do that don't mm-hmm. understand. And I think that at least some of them do. However, there is a big difference in payoffs. You know, business pays well, and the alternative pays nothing. So there is some value there.
Yeah, of course. I mean, you know, it's the old Upton Sinclair quote that, you know, it's impossible to convince a man of something when his salary depends upon him not understanding it.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, and I mean, can we talk about some of the ways in which the current system is set up to support incumbents, right? There's the banking system is a big part of it, right?
Yeah, I think that one big point that is not fully appreciated is what goes under the name in economics of regulatory capture. The idea that regulation very often ends up being run in the interest of the regulated industry rather than in the interest of the public at large. And mm-hmm. with this, I don't want to say that the solution is zero regulation. Absolutely not, because the zero regulation means sort of the Wild West, and that's not really a good and efficient capitalist system. However, I don't think people fully appreciate how problematic that is, because you have a regulator who, when they step down, they go and work for the industry that they regulated them. You have the academics that either sort of write for the industry or wants to become regulator, and so they support the system. And it's very hard to explain some of those issues to the public at large. You can get some public support for environmental laws, because polluted waters is something that affects everybody and is easy to explain what the problem is to people. But when it comes to accounting rules or to sophisticated banking regulation, very few people, even in academia, understand that. And most of them have an interest at stake. So the essence of democracy, which is a democratic debate and a free debate among various parties with conflict, with interest in conflict, so that eventually the truth emerges, is not there. And I think that the public at large, I don't think, is fully aware of that.
I would say I don't think you have to hedge your bets there. I think it's fair to say that they are not fully aware of that. And I mean, it's, again, like, I think that, you know, John Oliver on Last Week Tonight has done a good job of just really making the point that, you know, by making things boring and complicated, that is the best way to ensure that the people aren't watchful of them and aren't vigilant and don't know what's really going on.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that actually you guys on the radio and sort of people like John Oliver, etc., are very important in bringing these issues to life and making people interested. Because when people are interested and they exert pressure, I think that the democratic system does work. The problem is that most of the time, especially on issues like these ones of regulation, people are not interested.
Well, I mean, I don't think it's that they're not interested. I just don't think they realize how much it affects their lives. And
absolutely. They're not interested, not because of their fault. They're not interested because a lot of people make an effort to make them not understandable.
Yeah.
I think that, nobody really reads accounting rules for fun.
Oh, there's probably someone out there. I mean, on the internet, there's one of everything.
I want to meet that person.
I guarantee you, all you have to go on is reddit.com and you will find that person. I think that's the thing. And I think obviously it's part of the sort of the other side of specialization. I mean, you know, if you think about ancient Greece, you know, the archetypal democracy in Athens, I mean, you know, everybody was a smallholder farmer, but the level of complexity of issues that people were dealing with were probably not that complex. And so therefore, you know, it was fairly reasonable to be pretty well informed on all the major issues of the day, or even if you think about 1776. Now, we have a real challenge in the sense that, you know, obviously the financial regulations have gotten so much more complicated and so much more sophisticated, and there's so much more law that the real challenge is how do you then to create a functional simplicity with that information? So it's that you're able to take all of that regulatory capture that is going on and then turn it into something that captures most of the truth of what is the reality, but is so simple that a person can, in their spare 5 minutes, understand it and then get angry enough to demand change.
And actually, one of the things I propose in my book is to force legislation and regulation to be simple, even at the cost of being a bit inefficient from an economic point of view. I think we economists tend to be very proud of our sophisticated mechanisms to get things to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting skeptical because the more sophisticated the mechanism is, the more room there is for somebody to trick something complicated. When you make something extremely simple, might not be perfect, but the best is the enemy of the good. And in this sense, for example, I came down to support a separation between commercial investment bank along the line of what is called as Glass-Steagall. I wasn't such a big fan because I thought that we could do better. But the reality is the attempt to do better results in sort of having the system completely rigged because the rules are very complex. And so it's better to have a simple, clear-cut rule rather than a more efficient but more opaque rule.
Right, because the opaque system ends up becoming less efficient because what ends up happening is that it ends up being captured by special interests.
Exactly, you got the exact point.
Right, and I think that's interesting. I mean, the degree to which, because a lot of what we've found on this show, just talking to people such as yourself, but also neuroscientists and all of that stuff, is that the reality is that the human brain has not changed a whole lot in the last few 100,000 years.
Too bad.
Yeah. I mean, systems really, that's sort of the baseline. That's the immovable constant. And so you really have to work around and design systems that operate well with that basic piece of wetware.
Absolutely. And in particular, we also have to realize that in the secret of democracy is participation.
Mm-hmm.
And we cannot tax people too much, not only from a financial point of view, but also in terms of participation.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of things that I try to propose in my book are precisely how to leverage the small amount of participation that most people want to give. So some economists take the extreme view that nobody wants to participate because the cost is bigger than the benefits, which is technically true for most people. However, I feel that most people have a bit of social conscience that makes them participate a bit. After all, people do vote in election, even if they don't change the outcome, at least individually. So people have a bit of a social spirit, but they're not. Most of us are not heroes, so that you cannot expect to dedicate an enormous amount of time. So the secret of a good system is how to leverage the small desire to participate of a lot of people to improve the quality of the overall system.
And I think also to structure it so that you can increase that desire, because my desire to participate in a way that gets me no recognition is small, but people have a strong desire to participate in ways that are going to get them a lot of recognition. And so if you appeal to people's vanity instead of, because it obviously doesn't necessarily make direct economic sense, but it can make a lot of social sense in the sense of being seen to contribute, seen to do creative, productive things. There are ways to draw, to tap into drives that will drive participation.
Absolutely. We see Wikipedia works very well, basically tapping a desire of people to participate.
Right. And I don't know if you're familiar with Daniel Pink's book, Drive, but he does a very good job of breaking down essentially what he calls motivation 1.0, motivation 2.0, and motivation 3.0. And motivation 1.0 is basically the Hobbesian, Leviathan, fear-based society, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially, you scare people into conformity and behaving and not murdering and raping and pillaging. At a level that is not sustainable. You know, motivation 2.0 is capitalism, where you appeal to people's, you know, financial self-interest. And then motivation 3.0 is a lot of what we're seeing now, which is people's desire for, you know, self-actualization, basically what he says, autonomy, mastery, and purpose. And I think that's the thing, is that we haven't done a very good job. Like, funnily enough, in 1776, they did a much better job of tapping into that idea. The founding fathers all wanted to distinguish themselves. They wanted to really master this stuff. They wanted to understand them. The Romans, you know, at the best times in Roman history, the senatorial class really, you know, were motivated by a desire to be seen to contribute to the glory of Rome. So I think that's the thing, is we've lost a lot of that. And if we can tap into those drives much better, then I think you'll see much higher levels of engagement than a sort of homo economicus view would suggest is reasonable.
Absolutely.
Yeah. What are you working on now, Professor, or what do you think are the next steps in your work?
So I actually just took over a center here at the university named after George Stigler. George Stigler is a Nobel Prize winner who is the inventor of the idea of regulatory capture.
Mm-hmm.
And so my goal in the next few years is to trying to not only promote research in this area, but also make it available to a broader public, to make the concept of regulatory capture a household name. I was struck one day that I was talking with my wife and I mentioned the term capture, and she looked at me like I mispronounced an American word, which I often do. And so she's completely justified. And I said, well, my wife, who is an educated person, etc., has no idea about this concept, which is very important. So I decided that this is something I want to sort of spread out. So I would not only sort of do research and promote research, but also trying to diffuse it.
Well, and that's one of the points in your book that really struck me, and I was so glad and gratified to hear, is you talked about how there's a real judgment in academia on doing things that popularize.
Yes, I think that there is a risk of getting too much into an ivory tower in which we do perfectly something that nobody cares about. And I think that bringing a breath of fresh air is a good thing.
Yeah, and to then communicate it and to have, because I think that's the interesting disconnect, is that academia is now paying the price for that ivory towerism, in the sense that the general public doesn't understand what they do or why it's valuable, and then obviously doesn't want to fund it.
Yes, I think that's a big problem.
Yeah, and so, I mean, it's incumbent really on the academic community to make sure that the public is really understanding the value and the importance of what they're doing, if they want cash. I mean, it's that accountability system again, the genius of competition.
Yeah, but it's not only for accountability. I think also for a sense of purpose. I think that if you don't do something that eventually is useful, and you know, there are some research that are going to be useful in 100 years, others that have a much more direct impact. But I think it's important to keep in mind that the purpose is not to be brilliant among your colleagues, but actually to make the world a better place.
Right. And that's the real mark of brilliance, right? I mean, and that's part of the genius of capitalism, is that, you know, ultimately the market decides. And if you are able to create real world benefit, then that is the proof of the value you have created.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, well, I think that's fantastic. And I know for our listeners, because that's a big part of what we aim to do on this show, is to take great books, great ideas, and, you know, spread them out into the world and allow people the opportunity to experience them. so that they can move and so that they can have a real effect. So, I mean, that was very, very gratifying to us to read that.
I'm very glad, and I hope that listeners will start following what the Stiegler Center at the University of Chicago starts doing.
Absolutely, and I also hope they will read A Capitalism for the People by Luigi Zingales.
Thank you very much.
All right, thanks so much, Professor.
My pleasure. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Luigi Zingales. His book is A Capitalism for the People. This was a short one just because the professor had to go super quickly because he's so busy changing the world. But not as busy as Brian Callen, who literally didn't even have a half hour because he works that much. So pretty much turn on any channel of your hundreds of TV channels and Brian Callen is, there's an above average probability that you will be on them. All right, thanks so much, guys. Talk to you soon.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.